Wanted to announce that for those of us who are presenting posters at the poster session this evening, if we go over to basically where the cafeteria is, in the coffee break, we'll find the secretary, Suzanne, there, and she'll have the boards and blue pack and drawing pins and whatever else. So I'll be going over there, so come with me if you want to.
Okay, so I think we should begin. So it's Jan Konrad will give us a view of astral particle physics. He's very well known in this field, so I look forward to it.
Thank you, Kyle. In fact, the title of my talk is Statistician Astrophysical Searches for Dark Matter, and I changed the title just 5 minutes ago, or 10 minutes, before lunch, because I realized that, first of all, most of the problems that we have in these searches for dark matter are very similar to what Kyle talked about in the particle physics talk just before. That, in fact, depressed me a little bit because I think 90% of my talk is essentially a subset of what you have been talking about. So, and on the other hand, also, I realized that, you know, though I would probably give the astrophysical answer to Lewis' questions on H-naught, I still think that we are more particle physicists than astrophysicists in terms on how we view Bayesian and frequency statistics. So but I will give some remarks on this. So this is an overview of the talk I would have given. So direct and indirect dark matter detection for pedestrians, so some physics, but not so much. And then there are two things which we're doing, if this works. It seems to work. Okay, so there's some analog pointer. Okay, so there are two things which we are doing, of course, in searches, hypothesis testing and interval estimation, and there are a couple of special issues. Specialized issues which arise in these two subjects, look elsewhere effect, and I was hoping actually that Kyle would cover this in more detail in his talk. So the only thing which Kyle actually didn't cover, I won't cover either. And then we have some problems, because these are connected, applicability of Wilk's internal theorem, which I will give an example about. This is also connected to testing separate families of hypotheses, which is something a problem which we encounter in astroparticle physics searches for dark matter. There has been, in this conference series, which Louis has mentioned, there has always been also the question, why do we choose 5 sigma as a threshold, or the question of thresholds altogether, and how we can motivate them. And I also won't talk about that, because I thought it was covered in part of the presentation, but I think it's still good to mention it here, because it's something which we could discuss later, because it is something which we think about a lot. And then I go to interval estimation, which is what we do if we haven't discovered anything, so it's sort of anyway part of searches. And I will talk about some of the methods used. This is unified O-ring, what is known in particle physics as Feldman-Cousins, marginalization for nuisance parameters. There are some specialized methods which have been developed in astroparticle physics searches. These are known, for example, as Yellin methods for direct detection of dark matter. And I saw Yellin on the participant list, so I don't talk about this, and there's no time for it. I will talk about the profile likelihood, which is something which Kyle talked a lot about, and which is something which, in astroparticle physics searches for dark matter, has been, emerging as a way of treating nuisance parameters quite recently. We also have the problem that we often do fits in a constrained parameter space, and there are certain problems which are induced by this, and I will have no time to talk about it, unless I mention it. I will talk about the problem of complex likelihood functions, and this appears when you try to really pinpoint the particle dark matter. And I will have some, more or less informal remarks on Bayesian versus frequency statistics in our field. So the dark matter problem, one introduction described, one of the most important problems of modern physics. Actually, usually I write it as the second most important, according to David Gross. But then I realized, people were criticizing me. Why are you working on the second most important, not on the most important? But people usually guess the wrong most important problem. Can anyone guess what the most important problem in calling to David Gross is?
Money,
okay. Yeah, well, good answer. So detection of particle dark matter works this way. There are 3 ways of trying to do this. One is to collide particles at high energies and produce new particles, which then we hope are the candidates for dark matter, and this is what Kyle has talked about a lot. And there are 2 other ways, and this is what I call the astrophysical detection of dark matter, and this is that you have a dark matter particle, and it's going to interact with some detector material and scatter off on it, and this off-scattered nucleus most of the time will give some kind of trace in the detector. And this is called direct detection. And then you have the 3rd way, which is called indirect detection, where you have dark matter particles annihilating in astrophysical sources, and then in the annihilation process producing standard model particles, which we can detect. And so there are different detectors for doing these searches. So as I said, the LHC is the main detector for the main experiment for producing potential dark matter particles. And then we have a couple of different direct detection experiments. So these are usually detectors which are put far underground to reduce background, and then just sitting there and wait for dark matter particles to come along and scatter and give a signal in the detector. And then you have indirect dark matter searches in different species, depending on what particles are produced. So, for example, you have a satellite experiment called PAMELA, which looks for dark matter signals in the cosmic ray flux. You have Fermilab, which is very strong here in FLAC, looks for gamma rays. And most of the examples I give will be from this experiment. You have IceCube, which is a neutrino telescope, because you might get neutrinos out of these annihilations. And you have HESS or Veritas, which are Cherenkov telescopes, which also look for gamma rays. And so these detectors, these astrophysical detectors, they are in design rather similar, for example, the Fermilab or this direct detection experiment as the ones that Kyle just described for the LHC. many of the problems which we will have in astrophysical detection are quite similar to particle physics. And so statistical issues then arise on different levels. And I categorize it in two steps. So first you have a step where you have some raw data, some raw detector output, which you try to translate to some kind of physical observable. And as sources, you have instrumental background, so things which happen in your detector, which is not the signal that you're looking for. You have some irreducible background, and that irreducible background, of course, can be signal to some people. And you have on the other side the information you have is raw detector output, for example, digital signal from some kind of sub-detector or so. And to arrive then at physics observables and to remove this instrumental background, because that's that you're not interested in, there's already statistical techniques coming in. So it's hypothesis testing because you want to, you know, distinguish a potential signal from a potential but existing signal from an instrumental background, and this involves multivariate classification, and often we use machine learning to do this. And then you have also parameter estimation, because from this, you know, raw detector variables, like digits or something like that, you want to derive physical observables like energy or direction or something like that. And for this, we use methods like least squares, likelihood. And also here, you know, machine learning is something which could be used, multivariate regression, but it's not so often done. But I won't talk about this, because this is exactly the same problem that people in particle physics have. And then on the other hand, once we have these physical observables and got rid of the, you know, instrumental background, which we don't want to have, we still are left with some irreducible background. For example, in the Fermilab, you know, we have lots of gamma rays, which, you know, corresponds to an astrophysical signal, and many people are interested in that astrophysical signal. For us, as dark matter searchers, it's not so interesting. So for us, I call it irreducible background instead of a signal. And then on the other hand, we have these physical observables, so they are already derived. But so in Fermilab, for example, we have the energy and the direction of the gamma ray. And then, again, we have a hypothesis testing or a parameter estimation problem. And for hypothesis testing, so to establish a potential dark matter signal, we use the maximum likelihood ratio test, most of us. And for parameter estimation or interval estimation, there are just different methods. So for likelihood, the Niemann construction, some new posterior integration, and as I said, there are some methods which are specifically developed for these experiments. So what is the likelihood? And this we already saw. It's very similar to the likelihood that Kyle presented. It's a marked Poisson. So you have a Poisson process, which gives you the number of events that you observe in your detector. And this sigma here is essentially the same sigma that Kyle presented. It's a kind of cross-section, the probability for a dark matter particle to annihilate. And then you have an energy spectrum. So each of these events here is sort of marked with an energy, or labeled with an energy. And then you have a direction. So each of the events is also mentioned, it's also labeled with a direction spectrum. And so this comes from the astrophysical source that you are looking at, in indirect detection. And this comes from the particle physics model you have for your dark matter particle. So this will give you information about the dark matter particle, and thus these parts contain the parameters of interest. In particular, it's this annihilation cross-section, which is dependent on what particle dark matter model you have. The mass of the dark matter particle, which will reveal itself in the spectrum, and this is the yield per annihilation, which teaches you something about the composition of the dark matter particles in terms of the underlying model. So then in direct detection, it looks very similar. It's also a marked Poisson. You have a Poisson. You have in this case, it's not the annihilation cross-section, but it's still a cross-section. It's the scattering cross-section, and you can distinguish it dependent on what detector you have, and a spin-dependent on spin-independent part, doesn't really matter. And then you also measure a spectrum, which is the energy of this particle which is scattered away, and that depends on the mass of the dark matter particle which comes in. So in this case, the parameters of interest are the scattering cross-section and the dark matter mass. So then useful question to ask is if we can live with asymptotics or if we need exact methods. And I've listed here this different ways of detecting the dark matter, and then I give sort of a rough number of the signal expectation, sort of at the sensitivity limit and the corresponding background number. And, you know, for the interactive patient, I mean, it's sort of on a limiting case, I think. It's always, in fact, it's quite hard to decide of when you need to abandon asymptotics. But clearly for direct detection, you can imagine that you can't really work with asymptotics, but you should rather prefer exact methods. One important nuisance parameter is related to the dark matter density distribution, and this is a picture of a simulation of the dark matter density distribution. So what you see here is the galactic halo as it would look like if it would shine in dark matter. This is actually a simulation which is called Via Lactea. And you see, first of all, you know, we are sitting here somewhere. So we are sitting quite close to the center of a gigantic dark matter halo, which are all giving, you know, rise to some gamma rays from dark matter. And you see also lots of substructures here. So small, density enhancements of dark matter, which give rise to potential dark matter signals. And all these, you know, bright blobs here, provide potential targets for us to search for dark matter. So the point is that the production of this dark matter, of the particles which we're trying to detect, is proportional to the cross-section which we are interested in, and this density of dark matter to the power of 2. So it enters this number squared. So this is a nuisance parameter which we are very dependent on, which is in addition, it is degenerated with a parameter of interest. Not visible from here, but so this is only a simulation, and the uncertainties on this can be very large. And I will describe it. So this is in principle the likelihood, just adding the nuisance parameter. So you have this part here, which is number density of dark matter particles, and the uncertainty can be between 100 and 1,000% on this quantity. And then you have a background which has a 20 to 30% uncertainty. Even though this might be a modest uncertainty for astrophysical searches due to the large statistics that, for example, the Fermilab has, even these modest uncertainties have a huge impact on our results. So we really need a good way to deal with these nuisance parameters. And actually, I sort of suspected that that part of my talk would be very overlapping with the particle physics talk. So I really, my main point was going to be that our biggest problem comes from the nuisance parameters. But you made the same point. So the point is that since these are so important, and so I have so broad distributions, this is one of the things which we really need to be able to handle well. And for the direct detection, it's a similar situation, except that the nuisance parameters are a little bit different. So you have, again, the dark matter density plays a role, but it's not as important because it's not entering as the square. And then you have efficiency parameters for both the signal that you're looking for and the background, which are quite unknown. So in their case, the knowledge of the detector sensitivity is the more relevant uncertainty. But the size of the uncertainties are similarly, let's say, devastating as in the case of indirect detection. And in this case, just for those of you who know a little bit about this, I actually picked the worst cases for low mass WIMPs. If you take higher mass WIMPs, you can get rid of most of these uncertainties. So let's then switch to the first subject. Hypothesis testing and especially applicability of weak subtunnel steering. And, you know, some of you maybe have seen this on the archive, which is, you know, a sort of a claim of a line signal in Fermilab data. So this is an energy spectrum of gamma rays as recorded by the Fermilab. And so you see this power law here, and then you see this bump here, which is supposed to be a line. And, you know, certainly if you just look at this paper, there are already, you know, a number of statistical question marks, for example, how the trial factors are treated. And also, people have been trying to explain this line here with a different model, which is a broken power law. And this would constitute an example of a case where you have to test separate families or non-nested type hypotheses. So this is just to make the case that this is very, very actual problems, which we have very often. But I'm not using this as the case study that I want to discuss. I'm discussing a different analysis, which is the search for dark matter satellites. In fact, the first time I used an action button. So not quite as advanced as your talk. But so all these blobs that you see here, they are potential dark matter targets. And we'll see later that there are actually known objects in the sky which have been observed optically, which are called dwarf galaxies, which we use for looking for dark matter. But there's also objects which we believe could be there, but don't have any counterpart in other wavelengths. So they would be only observable in gamma rays. And this is what is searched for in this paper. And so in this case, this is a reference had been led from here, from Slack. The analysis applies a big Poisson likelihood. The energy model, the spectral model, is fitted. The spatial model is fixed to two benchmarks. And the Newton's parameters considered is only the background, and these are treated with profile likelihood. And so these are the likelihoods. So you have this, again, part marked Poisson, and then the spectral model is what is different for the different hypotheses. So in one case, you have the power law. And this parameter is to be estimated. In the other case, you have a dark matter particle spectrum. And for the sake of the argument, we can just parameterize it as an exponential. So in this case, this gamma would be the dark matter particle mass. And so this is, of course, not nested hypotheses. And so how is this problem attacked in the paper? So this is the test statistics, the likelihood ratio of these two hypotheses. So it's an obvious approach. You just take the direct likelihood ratio of the two fits that you obtain for your two hypotheses. And this TS BB bar is just a particle in which the dark matter particle annihilates. It doesn't really matter. So this HBB bar is the dark matter hypothesis, and this is the power law hypothesis. And this TSBB bar and TS power law is just the likelihood ratio of existence over source, which Fermilab gets out of the analysis. So these are nested statistics, and this is unnested. And they actually, we, I also co-signed this paper, realized that this is not a nested hypothesis, so we can't use the theorem or Chernoff's theorem to evaluate the significance. Instead, there has been run simulations to assess the significance of possible excesses. And the similar thing happens then for the two benchmark spatial models, and this is called TSX for extension, and you compare a point source hypothesis to something which is extended. MFW is just some potential spatial extension for a dark matter source. Again, this is the nested part. And then here it says, while the point and extended hypothesis are nested, and TSX looks like a likelihood ratio, it is not clear whether this analysis satisfies all of the suitable conditions for the application of theorems of Willicks and Chernoff. Therefore, we relied on simulations again. So to assess the null distribution, simulations are used, and that's quite often the case. But one should point out that most of the time it's not really possible to do these simulations to the full extent of the complexity of the experiment. So usually they're simplified. So it cannot be 100% certain that these null distributions are the one we would get from the experiment. Anyway, I should say that this is anyway quite a progress with respect to what has been earlier. Actually, also Roberto mentioned it, that people have just not, you know, even cared about if Chernoff or Willicks was applicable. They just, you know, applied it anyway. So it's actually quite good. I mean, I signed it. But of course, later I realized there is in statistic literature a way to test separate family hypotheses, and this is One way is to construct a comprehensive family hypothesis. So this is one possibility to do it. So this is called the linear mixture model, I think. So you have this comprehensive family, and it's just, you know, the one model and the other one with an additional parameter, which is the mixture parameter, 1 minus theta plus theta. And then the hypothesis test is recast in setting the mixture parameter to 0 and not specifying this vector parameters which had. The alternative hypothesis then have it unequal 0. And, you know, we didn't know about this, and actually I Googled a little bit on the World Wide Web, and in fact, the first paper to appear is this one, in 61 and 62, from Cox, and it refers to this already as the conventional method. So, as usual, in physics, we are like 50 years behind statistics. And in fact, he says that this is not a good method, you should use this method instead. It's also a mixture model, it's called the exponential mixture. So instead of a linear mixture model, you use an exponential. You have this mixture parameter as an exponential of the model that you have. And then, you know, there has been some work comparing these approaches by Atkinson in Kempty and Quant, and I guess there are many more. And this is something which I would like to get some feedback from statisticians here, actually. But anyway, we tested this linear mixture model on a spectral spectrum, which is the one which I just showed a couple of slides ago, and voila, we found actually a quite nice chi-square distribution for this, for the unbinned non-extended likelihood. It's also okay for the extended likelihood. However, if you bin the data in rather few bins, then you get deviations from the chi-square distribution. So this is all very preliminary work, but so we found actually that this linear mixture model gives quite satisfactory null distribution for our problem at hand. But that's, of course, not the whole story. In fact, you know, this is very fresh, as I said. Usually, you know, we first tried to study this mixture model and then looked at literature. So Quant in 70 tested this linear mixture model and could not recover a chi-square distribution for Gaussian variates. Define the chi-square as I showed you, but I have not showed you the cases where we get a chi-square, but where we don't understand the numbers of degrees of freedom. And this is something which I really would like to discuss with some statistician who feels that he knows about the separate families of hypothesis tests. That we might, there might be. I mean, it's funny because it still gives a chi-square distribution, but it's not an understandable degree of freedom in most cases. So maybe we can discuss it. Of course, in some way, this might actually not be necessary because the direct likelihood ratio, which is also discussed in this Cox paper, is conservative with respect to this comprehensive families of hypotheses. So in a sense, you know, even if we use this direct likelihood ratio, which has been used in the paper, which I mentioned, you know, we're losing a little bit of sensitivity, but we are not going to make too many false claims. And this is something which we in particle physics or in astroparticle physics can live with. In any sense, if the buffer approach is applicable to Fermilab's case, is still to be seen. I mean, there's a spatial part to be added, and there's also the present analysis is binned, and that we have shown is a problem. So this we don't know. Anyway, final remark is that, you know, I Googled for this in about 2 hours, and you know, I covered from 61 to 74. So I still have, you know, 40 years of statistical literature to look at. So I guess some improved solutions are out there. So that was my hypothesis testing. Oh my God.
No.
I just get to talk as long as I wish, okay, for this mistake. So to the interval estimation. And the main thing here is Newton's parameters. Let's see. This is a busy slide, but this summarizes how we treat the Newton's parameters. So Berkhold uncertainties in our field have routinely been treated with profile likelihood because we have been using, you know, packages like MinRead to do the fitting. And so the point is that many people use Minuit without knowing what it does. So people were not aware of the fact that they actually did profile likelihood to do the nuisance parameters, but this is what happened. If there are some examples where profile likelihood is used. This is rather simple, but this is a rather complicated case where the profile likelihood has to be constructed from a grid of models. For efficiency like nuisance parameters, so the ones which I have just shown you, like the density of dark matter, the most common way of fitting them was just affixing them to benchmark models. So you just say, well, assume it's 1, then we get this result. Assume it's 2, we get a different result, and that will somehow should give some feeling for the uncertainty. But as I said, recently the profile likelihood has emerged also to treat these nuisance parameters which I mentioned in the introduction, in the likelihood. So in direct detection, the Xenon 100 experiment has used the profile likelihood to treat the systematics in the instrument. And indirect detection, the Fermilamp has used it for analysis of dwarf galaxies, and I will give these two examples. I will maybe skip one of them if I don't have time. However, there's still an analysis to come which treats all the nuisance parameters and which, you know, uses good approximations on the distributions of the nuisance parameters, which we haven't so far. For completeness, there has been also exact methods used, and I think most of the time the methods which have been used are these hybrid Bayesian frequencies methods that Kyle mentioned. So it's a marginalization over the nuisance parameters combined with a Niemann construction. Shown an example here. So one common way, especially in the neutrino physics community, is to use the Feldman-Kaffin's approach, which is the Niemann construction with ordering principle according to the likelihood ratio. So you take the likelihood for the model of question plus some background and compare it to the model which best explains the data, and you order you order the observations in decreasing order of this likelihood ratio and include them into the confidence belt to arrive at the confidence interval. And then to treat nuisance parameters, the Poisson distribution, which is in this likelihood, is replaced by one Poisson distribution, which is folded with some uncertainty on, for example, predicted background or some efficiency curve. These integrals are done over true parameters. So this is assuming a flat prior and a Gaussian likelihood for these nuisance parameters. And so this is what this has been. I think this has been first suggested in physics by Hyland and Cousins, and I extended it to this unified ordering 2003. But this has been quite common. But you know, until profile likelihood emerged as a better solution. And so this is just to show the effect. This was for a prediction for the neutrino dark matter search from the sun, and how uncertainty in the signal efficiency would affect the upper limit which they get. So this is the flux of muons from the sun as a function of the neutralino mass. Neutralino is one of the candidates of particle dark matter. So you got sort of the square root scaling of the relative errors on the efficiency in the upper limit. Then the next example is from the Fermilab. It's dwarf galaxies. As I mentioned, these are these dark matter blobs. Some of them have some stars attached to them, and they then build a class of objects which are called dwarf galaxies. And this is just a picture of dwarf galaxies as dots here. And this is taken from another slide. So I have pointed out all the dwarf galaxies which have been observed by the different gamma ray experiments. And what happened in the Fermilab is that the observations of dwarf galaxies were combined by a combined likelihood. This is pretty much similar to what Kyle described as combining different channels. Now we combine different dwarf galaxies in one likelihood. So this is the likelihood. It doesn't matter in detail. So you have this is the product over the number of sources. Have essentially a Poisson likelihood with parameters which are common to all of these sources. In our case, the annihilation cross section for the dark matter particles. You have some individual source parameters, like this is this reducible background which I talked about. And then we added this term here, which is the, this JI is just dark matter density squared, it's just J. So we describe the uncertainty in this dark matter density as a log normal distribution, add it to the likelihood, and profile over it. So this is just an example of how the, it's quite complicated, plot, how the likelihood changes if you include this factor in the likelihood analysis. So for example, we can just look at this red line here. You should always compare the dashed lines to the solid lines. And the solid lines include the uncertainty and the dashed lines don't. So you see that the likelihoods, as expected, become broader. So your confidence intervals that you infer become worse. This is the result of this analysis. So this is the cross-section, which I mentioned, which is the WIMP mass, and these are the individual limits, upper limits inferred from the profile likelihood for the dwarfs, and this line here is the combined upper limit. In fact, the combination itself might be interesting to discuss, but I don't have time for that either. There is one subtlety which I want to mention at least. So we take this to be the likelihood for the uncertainties on the measurements of the dark matter density in the dwarfs. So this is an auxiliary measurement which is done by different groups which observe stars in these dwarf galaxies, and from the stars and their movement, they infer the dark matter density and how it evolves with radius. And what they do is they do a Bayesian analysis. So what they can provide us with is the posterior on this parameter. And of course, what we are doing is, and this is an example of a dwarf, the Draco dwarf, which has many stars, let's say, and gives a good constraint on this dark matter density. And compared to Segway 1, which is a dwarf galaxy, which is very faint and has a very much more uncertain determination of the dark matter density. They provide us with the posterior density, and this is sort of, you know, described as a log normal, but we just put it into the likelihood, as a likelihood term. And, you know, it's sort of motivated by the fact that they assume a flat prior in J, and we hope that's okay. But, you know, if somebody wants to criticize it, you know, I just want to show it. Something which the referee of the paper certainly missed, so he wrote it. But anyway. So then I have another example, which is the profile likelihood in direct detection. And so how much time do I have? 10 minutes. Let me try to speed up a bit. So the profile limits are presented even for the cases that call for exact methods. As I showed you in the beginning, the number of events observed is rather small. So you would probably prefer exact methods, but then profile likelihood is often used anyway. And in fact, this has a little bit to do with that coverage studies have shown that profile likelihood works satisfactorily even in cases where you would expect it to break down because of weak theorem is not asymptotic anymore. And this is one example of this, which is to refer to. So I will skip the details because in principle it's the same idea as the one of the dwarf galaxies. So the nuisance parameters are just added to the likelihood. I won't go into the details, and then the profile is over. So let me come to the final subject, which is Bayesian distance frequent statistics. And as I told you, and even though I'm here as an astrophysicist, I would probably for most part first try to solve things in the frequentist way before I resort to Bayesian methods. And I found this conversation, which was happening in the Fermilab, which is somehow a mixture between particle physicist and astrophysicist, quite interesting. So Jeff Scargill, many of you know, is an astrophysicist. And Elliot Bloom, also many of you know, is a particle physicist. So we are restricting the parameter to be larger than zero. Aren't we biasing the result, Jeff? And Jeff, is the parameter supposed to be larger than zero? Elliot, yes, it's a cross-section. Then it should be biased in this direction. Which is quite nice because, you know, as a particle physicist, you are very, very afraid of biasing your result in any way. But, you know, if you're a consequent Bayesian, obviously it's something you should do because it gives you, brings you closer to the true answer. And so this is the kind of things we have to struggle with in our collaboration, which is not so clear cut on the question of Bayesian versus frequentist statistics. But I think it's fair to say, I mean, most people looking at dark matter, even in the astrophysics community, are probably coming from particle physics, and I don't think that any claims for dark matter based solely on Bayesian method will be accepted by the community. So we'll have to show that the frequentist method reveals some significance, like 5 sigma or so. However, I think it has some use in the search optimization, obviously, and parameter estimation. And this is where we'll spend some time on this second chapter of parameter estimation. And this is inference and supersymmetry. And in fact, Roberto didn't talk about it, but he should have, because he's one of the very most active guys in this field. So he should really talk about this, I think. But you can ask him afterwards. So far we have been considering very simplified models, but if you really look at the particle physics level, the theories which predict dark matter, they have of the order of 100 or so free parameters. And the likelihood space of these models is very, very complicated, and I will show an example of this. And so, of course, there have been, you know, attempts to do inference in this very complicated likelihood space, and also mapping. The most effective schemes of sampling this likelihood space are designed for Bayesian inference, and I give some references here. In fact, the plus always contains Roberto. Just more recently, there has also been attempts to use the same sampling or scanning algorithms to use for profile likelihood, so for frequentist inference. And there are a couple of challenges with this. And these appear even in the full case with 126 or so parameters has not been studied yet. So far, people have been concentrating on a simple case, which is a four-parameter theory, which is called constraint minimal supersymmetric model. And so even in this case, there are some challenges to be met. So there is a prior dependence. So this is a plot which shows the two of these parameters. These contours are 68% and 95%, I guess, confidence contours on these parameters. And and the upper panel here contains flat priors, and the lower panel is logarithmic priors. And these are just two different set of parameters. You just see that if you go from a flat prior to the parameters to a log prior for the parameters, you significantly change the confidence intervals you obtain. And this is, you know, as I mentioned, this is of course perceived as a problem by people who are sort of, you know, frequentistically inclined. And of course, one of the things one hopes for is if this is, I mean, this is still an under constraint model in some sense. So it is supposed to be remedied if you include data, for example, from the LHC. And in fact, I think this has been shown. I think you showed it at some point that if you include, or you maybe, that if you include LHC data, in fact, this prior dependence disappears. But of course, you know, this is just a very restricted model, which we essentially know is ruled out already. So we don't know what's happening if we go to, you know, if we have to go to higher parametric models. And then another thing which sort of this question mark is still this frequentist properties, and in fact I want to take this opportunity, what most people in the particle physics community and also in dark matter particle searches have easier to accept is if you have a Bayesian method which you can show has good frequentist properties. So this is something we like to do to check the coverage even if the intervals are not obtained in the frequentist way. And, you know, if you look at this particular case of the CMSSM model, you find both over and under coverage in these two papers. And there are different couple of reasons which have been, you know, suggested for this. The bad sampling of the light curve. The over coverage is most probably due to the fact that the benchmark models are close to boundaries in the space. And you know, even for simple Poisson, you know that if you are close to a boundary of the parameter space, you get over coverage. I would also think that undercoverage can be connected to having flat prior in many dimensions, which is something which usually causes trouble, but I haven't checked that. And I mean, maybe the most challenging problem is the sensitivity to fine-tuning, and that's especially a problem of the profile likelihood. The profile likelihood, by construction, picks false or true likelihood peaks. And this is just one likelihood surface here, let's say, for a simple CMSSM model. So you'll see all this structure in this likelihood function. Of course, the maximum likelihood method, profile likelihood method, will pick this point. This fault refers to the fact that to go from these parameters in the supersymmetric theory to something which is observable involves very complicated numerical calculations and theoretical uncertainty. So we are actually not 100% sure that these calculations are correct. So these likelihood peaks might be artificial. And then, obviously, you don't want to pick up on that. But there's also a more, let's say, fundamental problem that you can have in this high-dimensional parameter space alignment of parameters, which is very careful to explain the data. So it is a true likelihood maximum, but still we don't like it because it involves what we call fine-tuning. Because you have to very, very much fine-tune your parameters in your model, and we don't like it. So we would like to punish this kind of behavior. And, of course, you know, this sort of seems to be most easily done in a Bayesian framework with something like this Occam's factor or something like that. And it's also shown that the profile likelihood is much more sensitive to adequate sampling of the likelihood. But this is more, maybe more technical problem. And the question which statisticians might be able to answer is, of course, if learning machines can help in this. I would intuitively say no, but okay, just wanted to mention it. And also just to show that this is a very, very, let's say, active field. This, in fact, just by chance, on today's archive, there was a paper which were, you know, studying this problem, and in fact they put in the abstract, this puts into question the robustness of the usual chi-square approach, which essentially is the profile likelihood. And in fact they assign it to some problem of calculating the likelihood. So in this case the profile likelihood approach actually has picked the wrong maximum in the likelihood. So that brings me to the summary. The statistical issues in our field, in astrophysical searches for dark matter, are largely overlapping with what the particle physics searches also see. And in fact, I already got some ideas from your talk, which will help us in our searches for dark matter. I think the main difference is that we have Huygens parameters which have very broad distributions, which are often degenerate with the parameter of interest. And so, in addition, the distributions are often not known. So I showed you an example where we at least had some posterior from a measurement, but most often we have, say, three theory groups which predict three values of the nuisance parameter, and then we'll have to do something with that. And what we do is we assume maybe a distribution for this. But this seems to be, you know, completely arbitrary. So the question is if there is some better way to treat these if you just have three values. For example, I don't know, maybe a non-parametric method or something like that. But for the moment, we just, you know, assume a reasonable parameterization and treat it with marginalization or profiling. But this is in red here because it's the central, you know, question mark, which I would pose to statisticians in the audience. Hypothesis testing situations for Chernoff and Wilks theorem are not applicable are quite common. Well, mostly because we have separate families of hypotheses to test. We also have the problem of trial factors. And, you know, before, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, these uncertainties in the nuisance parameters were essentially not treated at all. And the profile likelihood in our field emerged as a tool to deal with these nuisance parameters. And they're more or less becoming a standard. Well, based on two papers, maybe I can't say it becomes a standard, but it's a clear move towards, you know, using the profile likelihood to treat nuisance parameters. And I think people are getting sloppy again about checking if this is actually justified or not. I mean, justified, of course, the profile likelihood can always use, but to do inference using Wilks theorem. Discovery of particle matter, dark matter based on Bayesian hypothesis testing only, I don't think we'll see it. I think that the community which deals with this, even in astrophysical context, prefers frequentist solutions. But, you know, the present people can object to that if they want to. But it seems to me likely that one pinpointing the dark matter particle is a task. So parameter estimation in this, you know, underlying dark matter particle theory likelihood space we will face the challenges of inference in this likelihood space, and I think Bayesian methods clearly have a role to play in that space. That's it. Thanks.
We have time for maybe one good question for Jan. One or two?
If it's a bad question, I won't answer it.
I was told that you could probably just talk in the room, so I'll give you. So you made comments about kind of both sides of the asynchronous picture, but you made one statement that you didn't think any result would be accepted by the community if it was solely Bayesian. Is that correct? What is the basis for that statement? That seems a bit odd. Is that a statement about the stupidity of the community? Or
maybe Elliot wants to ask the same question, but from a different angle. I just think it's the same as a similar to what Kyle said. I mean, the notion to put bias on any of these parameters is something we don't like very much. I think you could try if you really could motivate and apply it very, very well. It might be bought, but I don't think so. So it's, I mean, okay, a simple answer to the question. From your point of view, yes, it's the stability of the community.
Do you trust the answer more that that's a parameter like a cross section to a negative value?
No, I mean, well, I mean,
you don't have to make a negative. You deal with that.
Yeah, well, you don't have to make it negative, but this is.
Anyone would be biased.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, the way this has been dealt with before, I think, and I mean, there are more experienced people in the audience, is that okay? If you have a mass measurement, for example, or a cross-section measurement, and if you happen to get a negative measurement, okay, that's just bad luck. I mean, we are all frequentists, and we are all, you know, happy with this, and so we'll have to present a negative. We know it's not true, but it's part of a big collective of experiments which will eventually yield the true answer. So we are happy with this. But of course, I mean, I agree that this kind of thing has caused troubles, because if you spend $50 million on some experiment and then the answer you get is wrong, of course you're not too happy. So people have been struggling with this problem, I agree. And in fact, I think, I mean, prior to, for example, Feldman-Castings, the problem was much worse, because some of the methods actually yield, for example, empty intervals. So you couldn't even give any answer, even not the wrong answer. So this is, of course, a problem, but it's not really a problem of statistics. It's more a problem that, you know, you might not be happy with the answer you get from your experiment.
I made the comment facetiously. I think that's not the reason why you stick with frequentist methods. I think it's just because, as a community, most people are more comfortable interpreting them. Weighted generation.
Yeah.
Be more comfortable misinterpreting. So I think this is interesting. I hope we can find more time to talk. I mean, there are several things that I actually like to say, but I think we need to move on to the week's talk. Okay, so we're going to think. Okay, so we have Luc Demortier telling us about the parametric bootstrap in particle physics.
So this talk is a summary of what I have learned about the parametric bootstrap over the past few months and some calculations that I have done. So an outline here, talk about the motivation for the bootstrap, and then go into more detail into interval estimation and hypothesis testing, and have a slide on bootstrap diagnostics, and then a summary and some references. So particle physics deals actually often with problems that have a very complicated dependence on both interest and nuisance parameters, and I think Kyle in his talk this morning demonstrated that brilliantly, with this spaghetti plot. I think it's a very good illustration of this problem. But the positive counterpart of this is that data generating processes can be modeled by Monte Carlo simulation. So inferences are difficult to obtain by exact methods in this field, and it turns out that the bootstrap provides a tractable numerical approach that approximates exact methods. So it's a frequentist methodology, and in terms of coverage accuracy, it bridges exact methods which we can't apply to our complicated problems, and asymptotic methods which lack coverage in small data sets. So essentially all that's required for applying bootstrap methods is the ability to generate toy experiments, and we have a lot of experience with that in particle physics. In addition, in particle physics, the data are typically independent and identically distributed, which is a situation that bootstrap methods generally apply to. And I wanted to quote this sentence here from a recent review paper. It says the following, read it for you. An important point is that subject to mild conditions, parameters of interest can be the output of an algorithm of almost arbitrary complexity, shattering the naive notion that a parameter is a Greek letter appearing in a probability distribution, and showing the possibility for uncertainty analysis for the complex procedures now in daily use, but at the frontiers of the imagination a quarter of a century ago. So this is a fantastic promise, right? It's absolutely exactly what we ordered. So thank you very much. Let's see how it works. So there are two basic ideas at the core of the bootstrap. The first one is the plug-in or substitution principle, and that's essentially what was expressed in the previous quote. Bootstrap inferences apply to parameters that can be expressed as functionals of the data distribution. So if you have a true distribution F, you have an estimate F star for that distribution, then you can apply the bootstrap to parameters that can be written as a functional of F and can be estimated by the same functional of your estimate of F. And this is very general, so it applies, for example, here in the simple case of estimating the mean of the distribution. This is the true mean, and then if F star is the empirical distribution function, then this is the estimate of the mean. And it can also be very complicated, as complicated as the sampling distribution itself. So when you're inferring F from a random sample of data without assuming that F belongs to a particular family of distribution. So the question then is, how does the bootstrap use your estimate of F to make inferences about the true F, the true population distribution? And that's the second idea underlying the bootstrap, that's resampling. The idea is just to generate toy data samples that are statistically equivalent to the observed data sample. And there are two ways of doing this. One is parametric resampling, where for the case where the underlying distribution of the data is known up to one or more parameters, and then you substitute estimates for those parameters, and you generate experiments from an estimated distribution. And the second possibility is non-parametric resampling. So the underlying distribution of the data is completely unknown, so you sample directly from the data with replacement. And to make clear what that means, you have a data set, x1 to xn. Each resample, you draw n data points at random from this set. And so, and then each selected data point is replaced in the set before making the next selection. Thus, some of the original data points may appear more than once in a resampled data set or not appear at all. And so in this talk, I plan to focus mostly on parametric situations because they are actually the most common in high-energy physics. But often, you know, bootstrap methods can be formulated for both types of systems. So main uses of the bootstrap, these are sort of the classical list of applications of the bootstrap: bias reduction, variance estimation, confidence interval estimation, and hypothesis testing. And I should mention here that Roger Barlow gave some lectures here, 2000, on bias reduction and variance estimation. So here's the link. And in this talk, I'll concentrate on confidence interval construction and hypothesis. Before going on to confidence interval estimation, I want to say a word about the consistency of the bootstrap. So the question here is, when can we be sure that a bootstrap estimator converges to the true value as the sample size increases? And there are theorems describing such conditions, and I'm not going to talk about these theorems, but I'll give you two examples where the conditions are not satisfied, and that is the bootstrap does not estimate consistently the distribution of a parameter estimated when the true value of the parameter is on the boundary of the parameter space. And, for example, it also does not consistently estimate the distribution of the maximum of the sample. So for such problems, there exist alternative sampling schemes, for example, subsampling, replacement and non-replacement subsampling. So going over to interval estimation, I have this quote here from a medical statistician in the early 1980s. A bewildering array of methods for constructing bootstrap confidence intervals have been proposed. And it is really bewildering. You know, there's an enormous amount of literature on that topic, and it's kind of difficult to put some organization, to put some order in that. At least I found it difficult. So I have... I've chosen an example from particle physics that I've actually, a few coincidences, I mentioned this morning, but I think it's a cultural example, so everybody's going to talk about this. So the idea is, suppose you observe a number of events that are so distributed with a mean that is the sum of an unknown signal intensity, which is a parameter of interest, and an unknown background contamination, that's a Newton's parameter. And then to constrain the background, you have an additional measurement, a linear measurement of the number of events K, that's distributed, also distributed with a mean tau nu, where tau is a known constant. So we wish to construct a confidence interval for data. So this looks like a really simple problem, but it has three complications. First of all, there is a Newton's parameter. There are physical boundaries at theta equals zero and u equals zero, and the sample space is discrete. And this is actually not trivial complication. But it's a very typical problem in high energy physics, and some people even want to, for example, construct a histogram. You have a histogram of observed data counts, and you want to subtract a background histogram from that in order to obtain a pure signal histogram, and so you would be confronted with this problem in each bin of such a histogram. So, common. So, just to fix the notation here, I wrote down the joint probability mass function of primary measurement, auxiliary measurement, and then you can calculate likelihood ratio for testing a given value of data. That's given us this ratio where the double hat indicates the profile maximum likelihood value of nu, or the maximum likelihood estimate of nu for fixed value of data. And then with only one hat, it means the global maximum likelihood estimate. So when all these maximum likelihood estimates are constrained to be positive for physical reasons, and then observed values are indicated like this, and observed, okay, observed, and from then you can obtain observed estimates. So I looked at a number of confidence interval techniques. At first I did an exact likelihood ratio test inversion, the reference to compare the other methods with. And then I looked at the asymptotic version of the first method. And then I looked at the naive method. Every time a colleague comes, almost every time a colleague comes to me and asks me for a method for solving a problem like that, they would ask me, well, what if I use this very, very simple method? What is the difference with your complicated method? And so you always have to try and justify why the naive method doesn't always work properly. So, then I also look at the Bayesian elimination of the nuisance parameter. That is what Ian talked about in the previous talk. And then four bootstrap techniques, simple percentile, the automatic percentile, and then some likelihood ratio test conversion. So the first method is what I call the exact likelihood ratio test inversion. So this is not a bootstrap method. And so an alpha confidence level region is defined as a set of state values for which the probability for observing a likelihood ratio or -2 log of the likelihood ratio less than or equal to the actually observed one is most alpha. And the way the nuisance parameter is handled in this situation is you must minimize the probability of all values of the nuisance parameter. So this is kind of a projection method for dealing with the nuisance parameter. And if you write Q alpha for the alpha quantile of the distribution of this likelihood ratio, then that equation is equivalent to this one. The confidence level region is defined as a set of all theta values for which the observed -2 log likelihood ratio is less than the maximum, than the quantile maximized with the mu. And so this shows you a plot of the coverage obtained from this method. Since you have two parameters, there are different ways of plotting this coverage. What I did here is just plot a band that extends from the minimum coverage as a function of mu to the maximum coverage as a function of mu, where mu varies between 0 and 20. Just put together a reasonable range. And of course, as you see, so this is a 90% confidence region. And as you see, of course, as expected, the coverage is everywhere at least as high as 90%. And then the second plot shows the expected length as a function of theta. And again, it's a band because it's the expected length range when you vary the nuisance parameter between 0 and 20. So then I looked at the asymptotic version of the previous method. So here, an alpha confidence level region is defined as a set of theta values for which the observed negative twice log likelihood ratio is less than chi squared for 1 degree of freedom, for the alpha quantile of the chi squared for 1 degree of freedom. And as you can see, at small values of theta, you get quite a bit of undercoverage with this method. But things get better as you increase theta. And then on the right-hand side, you have, the plot of the expected length. That's the blue band. And the dashed line is the result of the previous method, the last method. And so this shows that the expected length for the asymptotic method tends to be smaller than for the exact method, which explains the undercoverage. So then the naive method, the idea here is that you can calculate an estimate, actually a likelihood estimate of theta, n minus a over tau. And then if you just ignore the constraint that theta has to be positive, variance of this is theta plus mu plus mu plus tau. You can again estimate this this way. And so you just construct a standard interval for theta when we need a normal time. And coverage of this method is really quite bad. It's under coverage everywhere. And its expected length is quite a bit smaller than the expected length of the test. So this is definitely not a very good method. And then the last non-bootstrap method that I looked at is the so-called Bayesian elimination method, followed by an exact likelihood ratio test inversion. So the idea here is you have this probability mass function, and the new component of that function is reinterpreted as a prior from you, and then you just integrate the PDF for the primary measurement and over that prior, and you calculate the likelihood ratio from this marginalized distribution. And then you just do a likelihood ratio test inversion, but you don't have to worry about the Newton parameters anymore. And however, the coverage is calculated in exactly the same way as for the other method. So the coverage is calculated as fixed values of theta and mu, and fluctuating both n and k. And so this is the result that you get. So this method tends to overcover quite a bit, and some spots of undercoverage. I did not, was not able to produce a plot of the expected length in this case, because if you think about it, this quantile here, it not only depends on theta, but it also depends on k. So because this distribution here depends on the prior, it depends on k. So effectively, for every time you make a new measurement, you have to recalculate the quantile. Your quantile depends on your observation, so that's a lot of work to compute. Okay, so this is then the first bootstrap method that I looked at, the simple percentile, also called Ephron's percentile, opposed to Hoare's percentile. The idea is that we just plot the distribution of the estimator theta hat, and then you set the interval endpoint to the 1 minus alpha over 2, one plus alpha over 2, 1 times of that distribution. And the distribution is a bootstrap, it's a parametric bootstrap distribution. So you substitute an estimate for theta and mu in that distribution. And so this is the coverage that you get. So you have substantial under coverage, especially at low values of theta, and the expected length is often smaller than the exact measure. And then I did what's called the automatic percentile. And this is actually sort of a combination of a percentile method with a test inversion method. So if G here is the cumulative distribution of theta hat, the interval endpoint are the solution of these two equations. If you did not have the Newton parameter, you did not have that mu, this would be exact equation. So this would give you the exact endpoint of an exact interval. But because you have the Newton's parameter, what you do, you substitute the profile maximum likelihood estimate of U into this equation, and then you solve it. So this is the coverage plot. But as you see, I mean, here you have a lot of things going on, a lot of undercoverage here. So the automatic percentile, you still have under coverage, but it's more balanced and there's less under coverage than with the simple percentile. And then the last two bootstrap methods I looked at are based on the likelihood ratio test inversion. So in this case, if you remember, for the exact method, I calculated a probability like this, and I minimized it over the nuisance parameter new. For the bootstrap method, I don't do the minimization, but I replace new by its maximum likelihood estimate. And then I solve that equation. And again, you can rewrite it in terms of the quantile of the distribution of minus two likelihood. And so this is the likelihood ratio, the coverage plot that you get in this case. It's much, much better than the other plots that I have shown so far, except for the first one, of course. There's still a bit of undercoverage here. That I can see over, and then a little bit of undercoverage over there, but it's quite nice. A variation on the previous method is, instead of substituting the maximum likelihood estimate of mu, you substitute the profile maximum likelihood estimate, and that still improves a little more, and you don't have that in the coverage at zero that you had in the previous method. So as an approximation method, this is the best one. So I have a few lessons from this bootstrap computational study. The first lesson, and that's actually quite generally true for bootstrap calculations, is that one should always use what's called a pivot, or at least an approximate pivot. Pivot is a function of both the data and the parameters whose distribution does not depend on any unknown. So I give you a few examples. If you have a location parameter, for example, the mean of a Gaussian, then the estimated mean minus the true mean divided by an estimate of the standard deviation, that would be a pivot for that particular problem. The likelihood ratio is, if not always a pivot, it's often an asymptotic pivot, so distribution being chi-squared, probably. The cumulative distribution function of an estimation of the quantity of interest is, of course, that distribution is also a pivot. So, if you bootstrap a pivot, then you're sort of guaranteed that your distribution and your inferences are going to be less dependent, if at all, on any unknown parameters. That's why it's important to always try and use a pivot. So, for example, if you want to calculate an interval, if u, x, and theta is an exact pivot, and suppose that it's a monotone function of theta, then solving this equation for theta, where u alpha and u beta are quantiles of the u distribution, will give you beta minus alpha confidence interval for theta. The second lesson is that test inversion also seems to improve the performance of the bootstrap. This is essentially the difference between the simple percentile and the automatic percentile method. This method can be computationally demanding, but there exist approximate solutions, and I have written down here a simple algorithm to approximately solve this equation. You start from an initial approximation, and then basically what you have to do is calculate quantiles under known distributions. And basically, this algorithm only requires calculating the distribution of the estimate of theta under three sets of parameters. So it's a fairly straightforward algorithm. And finally, the third lesson is how to handle nuisance parameters. And in the statistics, so here we've talked a lot about profiling. In the statistics literature, what you find is that you're supposed to handle nuisance parameters by reduction to a least favorable family. And that's actually an idea that goes back quite a while. I think it comes from a 1956 paper by Stein. And the idea is the following. So suppose that you X here is a distribution that depends on a vector of unknown parameters. You're interested in a one-dimensional quantity theta. So what you have to do first is to reduce this multidimensional family to a one-parameter least favorable family to your estimate of eta. So you have, you reparametrize, so you have f hat of x in tau, efficient in this way, and then delta is given in terms of the official information matrix. The idea behind this least favorable family thing is that the official information bound or an unbiased estimate of theta is in this one parameter family is the same as in the full multi-parameter family. So one way to rephrase this is to say that inferences about theta have not been made easier by restricting attention to a one-parameter family. And another example of least favorable family is the family where you replace eta by its profile estimate, profile maximum likelihood estimate. And in addition, the family has a property that it transforms directly under reparametrization, which can go over to automatic percentile limit. So that's another nice property of these intervals that they are equivalent under reparametrization. And there exist, as I mentioned already, there exist many other bootstrap confidence interval constructions. At least in the early literature, there was a lot of talk about the bootstrap T method, which is based on bootstrapping a pivot, such as U hat minus U over sigma hat. This works well for location parameters, provided, you know, sigma hat is an estimate that has limited variance. If it has a big variance, then it's not going to behave delayed very well. There are this tool called the bias vector percentile, bias vector accelerator percentile, that Gareth mentioned this morning. You can repeat the bootstrap, you can do the double bootstrap, and you can calibrate existing confidence limits using the bootstrap. So all these constructions differ in their coverage, accuracy, and other properties, such as equivalence and the parametrization. So I have a table here. This is an attempt to classify these methods. You have a class of pivoting methods, and then a class of methods that are based on percentiles, and then a class of methods based on test inversion, and then the coverage accuracy is basically the speed with which the coverage converges to the true value as a function of the sample size. So you can always improve the coverage accuracy by doing calibration or bootstrap iteration. Okay, going over to hypothesis testing. So hypothesis testing is typically done with p values in high energy physics, and I just want to make a couple of comments about that. First of all, it's important that when you test, the resampling reflects the null hypothesis. And I give you an example. So if you have two samples, sample of X and sample of Y, and you wish to test whether the underlying population and the same mean, you can use this cool T statistic. And you should not really resample separately from the X and Y samples. You should sample instead from the pooled samples of X and Y, because that really represents your null hypothesis that the two populations have the same mean. And of course, you could, in principle, bootstrap just X minus Y, but it is better to bootstrap the distribution of a pivot like this. You'll get faster convergence to a confidence interval with good coverage. An interesting result is the following. If the p-value is based on the test statistic T and the distribution of T is asymptotically normal to the mean A that depends on the parameter of interest, then one can show that the parametric bootstrap p-value is asymptotically uniform if the mean of T does not depend on theta and is asymptotically conservative otherwise. And I'm illustrating that with, again, this is an example from high energy physics. So suppose you have a count n Poisson would be painted as this new, but this time I put a Gaussian CDS for the auxiliary measurement of new. So new has to be positive, but assume that X will in principle be fluctuate negative or positive. Then you wish to test whether theta equals zero. So you calculate the constrained maximum likelihood estimate of new under the null hypothesis, that's this expression, and you substitute that in the tail probability expression for the p-value, and that's called the plug-in p-value. This is a p-value that makes double use of the data. First of all, it uses the data in the calculation of the estimate of new, and then again in the calculation of the tail probability. One of these tends to favor the null hypothesis. But then on the other hand, don't take into account the uncertainty on you, which works against the null hypothesis. So now, if I can show you here some plots, the dashed lines here are plots of the probability for p to be less than or equal to a given alpha, the function of alpha. It's the coverage of the p-value as a function of alpha. A good p-value, a uniform p-value, would have a curve that lines up with the diagonal here. And so as you can see, the dashed line corresponding to the plug-in p-value is below the diagonal, meaning that it's a very, very conservative p-value. And so in order to improve on that, you can do a kind of double bootstrap, which works as follows. If you knew the exact cumulative distribution function of the plug-in p-value under the null, then you would be able to construct an exact p-value. But again, if you do not know that exact distribution function, you have to estimate it, and you do that by substituting parameter estimates. And when you do that, you get considerable improvement in the behavior of the p-value. So you see that this is the solid line in this plot. Solid line is generally much closer to the diagonal. An interesting question is how many bootstrap resamples do you need to do hypothesis testing? In fact, it can be shown that if you do only a finite number of bootstrap applications, then your test will tend to be less powerful than if you were to be using the whole set of bootstrap applications or an infinite number of bootstrap applications in the case of the parametric bootstrap. There is a nice algorithm proposed by these econometrists. Suppose that you're not interested in the exact value of the p-value, but you only wish to determine whether your p-value is less than a threshold or above that threshold. So then you can use this kind of pre-test procedure. You start by computing your test statistic from the data, and then you set the number of bootstrap resamples to D, and you compute B bootstrap samples, and then you compute the estimated p-value based on these B bootstrap samples. And if the estimated p-value is less than alpha, then test the hypothesis that the ideal p-value is greater than alpha at some level beta using binomial statistics. If the hypothesis is rejected, then you're done. Then you know that the p-value is less than alpha, you have a significant effect. If the estimated p-value from this bootstrap sample is greater than alpha, then you test the other hypothesis, and again, if the hypothesis is rejected, stop. If you don't manage to stop here, then you just increase the number of bootstrap samples, and then you go back to step two. In principle, this allows you to avoid having to do too many bootstrap resamples, especially when the alpha is very small. Of course, in econometrics, they're quite satisfied with an alpha of 0.05 millimeters of alpha. actually not that bad. So they found that beta equals 0.1% and the maximum of 3,800 good sample samples yields good performance. In our case, we have an alpha of 2.87 times 10 to the minus 7. So it may be worth looking into this, but one would have to determine what's a good value for beta and for the maximum number of these samples. And this will, of course, also depend on the problem that one is solving. A slide on the look elsewhere effect. The look elsewhere effect in high energy physics is just the idea that when you look for something over a certain range in a certain region, and you observe an effect, the significance of that effect should be degraded for the fact that the background could have fluctuated anywhere in your search range. And in the statistics literature, this effect comes up under different guises. One label is hypothesis testing, where the nuisance parameter is present only under the alternative. That refers to the fact that the location of your signal is a nuisance parameter when you're trying to determine the significance of your signal, but that location is totally undefined under the null hypothesis of no signal. And another way in which this problem shows up in the statistics literature is under inference for the number of components in a mixture distribution. So this is an example here. Suppose you have a distribution. You're testing whether the data is distributed according to a standard normal or according to a mixture of two Gaussian distributions. And so the null hypothesis corresponds to pi equals zero or mu equals zero. So what you have here is that the parameter is on the boundary of the parameter space, and H0 corresponds to a non-identifiable subset of parameter space. So the classic theorem about the asymptotic properties of the maximum likelihood estimate and the likelihood ratio do not hold. This has been emphasized already by previous speakers today. So bootstrapping the parameters will not work since they are not identifiable. However, the likelihood itself is identifiable. When you have a well-defined likelihood under the null hypothesis, you can construct a likelihood ratio. So bootstrapping the likelihood ratio will work in contrast with bootstrapping a walled statistic, which is basically mu hat minus mu over sigma hat. So that's actually a good news. Okay, a slide on bootstrap diagnostics. That's an important subject. So how can we assess the reliability of bootstrap calculations? There are several concerns. One is, first of all, if you have data outliers, this affects not only the non-parametric bootstrap, but also the parametric bootstrap. When you calculate estimates from your data, these estimates may be biased by data outliers. So in principle, you could check this effect by removing data points one by one from the sample. So that of course, incorrect resampling, that is sometimes a problem. Even for parametric bootstrap, it can become a problem when you have many nuisance parameters. Maybe over-determining your system and then underestimating the total viability. Obviously, if you have many nuisance parameters, then how do you know that you're modeling your system properly when you have so many nuisance parameters? So this is an issue for which it does not really exist a general recipe for testing like that. I mentioned already the importance of working with pivots, but non-pivotality, so this is something that in principle one can check by examining, how the mean, the variance, and the quantiles of the distribution of the bootstrap quantity changes with the true value of the quantity you're interested in. And then there's the problem of inconsistency. I mentioned that at the beginning. So there are cases where it's possible to check whether or not the bootstrap is consistent, but there is no general recipe. So this is, and I'm quoting here from this paper, further theory and more diagnostics are necessary before bootstrap procedures before become fully trustworthy additions to the statistical toolkit. So this is a bit of a less optimistic point than the one I was making at the beginning of the talk. So here's my summary. The bootstrap is a frequentist tool that bridges exact calculation of a static one. Bootstrap inferences can be obtained for any quantity of inference that is the output of an algorithm, regardless of complexity. For confidence intervals, the coverage accuracy of bootstrap procedures can be improved by bootstrapping a pivot, by using test inversion, and by bootstrap iteration. For hypothesis testing, bootstrap resampling should always reflect a null hypothesis. Look elsewhere if it can be handled by bootstrapping a likelihood ratio, and there is still a need for more tools to help diagnose misbehavior of bootstrap procedures. And then I have all the references that I mentioned in the talk. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There's a lot of material. I always find that Luke's talks are very useful about 2 years later when I'm catching up as reference. So does anyone have questions for Luke? I have two questions. One was that on your slide 22 way back when you showed this one of the bootstrap approaches. So this one that looks so good, I was happy because if I'm reading it correctly, that's exactly what it is that we've basically adopted at the LHC for dealing with the...
That's the method that you mentioned this morning.
One thing that we should do for ourselves is to, since you've done the literature search, is to make sure we're sort of quoting the proper... I had a question on slide 15. When you did this one that didn't go so well, I was curious with the asymptotics that you have a boundary on your parameter theta, but you're using the sort of normal chi-square distribution for the cutoff. So at least we do have, you know, in this one paper we sort of dealt with the modifications to the chi-square that come from that boundary, even though you have the asymptotics.
Right.
So am I reading it correct that that could be included? Like when you do the fifth, theta is still bounded. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, theta is bounded when I do the fifth. But I just use
so it would be interesting to see if you include those effects of the change.
Any other questions? When you talk about intervals, you were focusing on intervals for scalars. Is there a quick summary of the situation for joint intervals? I guess I think my impression is that for parametric bootstrapping, there are good ways to do it, but non-parametrically, it's still kind of an open issue.
I don't know. I don't know. It's rather than anything.
Any other questions for Luke? Okay, well, thank him again. So next we have Luke Cowan, who's going to tell us about a couple of projects that he's been working on.
Is that okay? Okay. So thank you very much. As advertised, I will talk about the two issues that have come up in the past year. And I hope they don't seem too, I don't know, they're not earth-shattering, but these are real problems that we've had to deal with in the past year. And here's the basic two problems. So it's sort of a two-part talk. So a lot of times when we're searching for a signal process, we need to estimate the rates of background processes, which will also be found. And the optimal way of doing that is to set up control measurements based on real data. But in practice, that's never possible for all components of the background. And so we rely on Monte Carlo simulations, usually, to simulate at least some, to obtain estimates of at least some components of the background. Now, the problem is that many of these Monte Carlo generators that we work with produce events that have weights. And so the question is then how to deal with that, how to appropriately take into account
the limited sample of Monte Carlo data that we have and the fact that they have weights in assessing the significance that we will quote as the result of some statistical test. So that's the first part. And then the second part is somewhat related, and that is that we would like to have some measure of the expected discovery significance in a search for a new process. So some measure of the experimental sensitivity for purposes of optimizing a planned experiment. That would be the main use. And so, for example, if you have an experiment where you're counting some number of events where S represents the mean number of signal events, B represents the mean number of background events, then this quantity S over the square root of B has been often used, and it represents sort of an approximate expected discovery significance. And so what I want to show is a measure of discovery significance that somehow generalizes this to the case where the background rate is not known exactly but has some uncertainty. You're thinking, another one? Because I think this topic has come up a number of times, and so, yes, I have yet another formula for the experimental sensitivity for that situation. Okay, so I'll try to get through those two things. Okay, so first of all, this business about using Monte Carlo events in a statistical test. And so the prototype analysis that I'm talking about is exactly what Lucas has mentioned and Kyle as well, and that's this problem where you have a region of a phase space or a set of cuts that defines a certain number of events that you will count. And I will model that as following a Poisson distribution with a mean value of, I'll say, mu S plus B. So I've changed my notation here slightly. S is still the expected number of signal events from some nominal model, and I will regard that as known. B is the expected number of background events, and I will treat that as a nuisance parameter. And mu is a strength parameter. It's just convenient to define it such that mu equals 0 corresponds to the background-only hypothesis, and mu equals 1 corresponds to the nominal signal hypothesis. Now, the ideal way of doing this would be to constrain this nuisance parameter B by setting up a data control sample based on real data. And in that, I could measure some number of events M, and that could be modeled as following a Poisson distribution with the mean value of a scale factor tau times B. And the scale factor tau usually can be taken as known. I will take it to be known. So now the reality is that it's not always possible to construct a data control sample, and so we have to take the prediction for B from Monte Carlo. Now, from a statistical perspective, you run your Monte Carlo generator, you generate some number of events, you look and see then how many of those events wind up in the signal region, and you can treat that as if it were sampled from some distribution. Strictly speaking, I should take it sampled from a binomial distribution because the total number of events I've generated is fixed. But the fraction of events which will wind up in the signal region is very small, so I'm going to model... Does this laser pointer not quite work? I will model that number of events found as following a Poisson distribution. That's just convenient because it allows me to treat the Monte Carlo events the same way that I would treat real events. Okay? In that case, the scale factor, tau, is simply basically the size of the Monte Carlo data sample divided by the size of the real data sample. So it's the ratio of the effective luminosities of those two data samples. Right? So... Now I get to this complication that most of the Monte Carlo generators that we really work with don't just spit out individual events, but each event carries a weight. So that means that the outcome of the experiment is N, the number of events I find in the signal region, M, the number of Monte Carlo events I find, also in the signal region, and then also for each Monte Carlo event, I have a number, a weight, W1 through WM. And so the question is now, how can I use all of those numbers to construct a statistical test of the parameter of interest mu. Right? So the usual, I guess this means sort of usual by my perception way, is to construct an estimator for the nuisance parameter B. So what plays the role of the number of events now is simply the sum of the weights. And so an estimator for B is simply up to the scale factor, the sum of the weights. And then its variance can be estimated with this a factor here, which is related to the sum of the squares of the weights.
And then you can simply tack on to your likelihood a term which would correspond to a Gaussian distribution for this B hat. So that would correspond, if you're going to minimize a chi-squared, it would correspond to adding a constraint term like that to the chi-squared. Now, there can be problems, though. So this is very often, I think, what people do in reality in particle physics. But what, for example, if M is 0 or is 1? You know, suppose you only observe a couple of Monte Carlo events in this signal region. Then the distribution of B hat is definitely not going to approach anything like a Gaussian. And so using a constraint term like that is not going to be appropriate. So here's a hypothetical example, and that is, suppose that the number of Monte Carlo events you find is 2, right? And so I guarantee that they're random. You have a purely hypothetical example. Suppose the weight of the one event was 0.13, and the weight of the other event was some 3 orders of magnitude less. Right? So on the basis of those 2 observed Monte Carlo events, the person who was contacting me came up with an estimate of the parameter B, which is very close to 0, with an error bar of 0.003. Then you look at the real data, and suppose you find one event. Well, if your expected background was essentially 0 with an error of 0.003, and you saw one event, then you might start to get excited and think that you've really discovered some new signal process. But the fact that these 2 weights here differ by 3 orders of magnitude turns out to be important. Wait, I had a comment. What was I supposed to say here? Right. So the correct procedure here, I hope it's correct, is that we have to make some ansatz for the distribution of these weights. So that's what I'm going to explore now. So, before I get to that, I want to say a few words about the test statistic I've used to test mu. And so we've just been using this profile likelihood ratio that several people have talked about now. So we'll have some likelihood function, which is just going to be it's going to contain the Poisson terms for the number of those events, and then something for the distribution of the weights, which I have to specify. And on the basis of that likelihood function, I'll construct this profile likelihood ratio, and using that profile likelihood ratio, I'll construct the test statistic such that if that Q0 is large, that corresponds to a large discrepancy between the data and the background-only hypothesis. Okay, so with that statistic, then I will obtain a p-value of the background-only hypothesis. So fine. To do this, I need to know the distribution of Q0. And to know that, I need to know the distribution of those things that I am regarding as measured outputs. And that includes these weights. Right? Okay, so keep going. So let me suppose that the weights follow a Gaussian distribution. Then the full likelihood function, as a function of then the parameter of interest mu, and the nuisance parameters b, omega here is the mean value of the weights, and sigma w is its standard deviation. So the likelihood function contains a Poisson term for the number of events in the signal region, a Poisson term for the number of Monte Carlo events in the region, and then this term here for the distribution of the weights. So actually, it was kind of nice to notice that this then only depends on the weights through the sum of the weights and the sum of the squares of the weights. So those form n, m, and that sum form what is the technical term, jointly sufficient set of something. I'm sure the word sufficient comes in there. Right. So that's one possibility. On the other hand, we could question perhaps this ansatz of a Gaussian distribution for the weights, because after all, the normal way that they're constructed, they're constrained to be positive, right? So a Gaussian tail, you shouldn't have a tail that goes negative. And furthermore, they might have a very long tail extending to very high positive values. And so it might be more realistic to assume a log normal distribution for the weights. And so here I've defined lowercase l to be the log of the weights. So then if I want log normal for the weights, then l follows a Gaussian distribution with a mean lambda and a standard deviation sigma l, and they are given by the expressions I've shown here. And so then the log likelihood function is a little bit different, okay? So it has similar terms but related to L and sigma L. Okay? Other than that, it's similar to the log likelihood function before. So again, the sufficient statistics here are N, M, the sum of the logs of the weights, and the sum of the squares of the logs of the weights. Right? And finally, as a third option, I can assume a normal distribution for an estimator of B. So I can take as my estimator up to the scale factor. It's just the sum of the weights. That would be its standard deviation. And so if you assume that this B hat follows a Gaussian distribution, then the log likelihood function up to an additive constant takes on that form. Okay? Normally, you would only use that ansatz when the probability of getting, say, zero of events in the Monte Carlo sample, it would be negligible. Okay, so here's a test procedure that will explore those three options. So suppose you wanted to generate events according to an exponential distribution within some finite range, x between 0 and some cutoff a. And suppose we were too stupid to do that with just ordinary Monte Carlo. The only thing that we knew how to do was to generate uniformly distributed numbers. Right, g of x goes as 1 over a, with x between 0 and a. But then for each event, you get a weight, and that weight is the ratio of the PDFs. So one thing you could do, of course, is you could just accept the event with a probability proportional to the weight, and that would convert your weighted sample to an unweighted sample. But let's suppose that I don't want to do that. So one of the things that you can work out in this case is that the weights will follow a distribution that is proportional to 1 over W between certain minima and maxima, which are easy to find. In general, it won't be easy to write down. You won't be able to write down the distribution of the weights. In this toy problem, I can. Right. So here are two toy data samples. So let's see. Suppose the number of events I find in the signal region is 17. The scale factor tau is 1. And now here are two cases. One, I've set the parameters of the exponential such that the weights all are roughly close to 1. Okay, so it's the limit of the range is 5, but the length of the exponential tail is 25. So if I generate 6 events, these are the values of the weights, and they're all very close to 1. So very narrow distribution for W. In case 2, the width of the range is still 5, but the length of the characteristic decay length of the exponential is 1. So if you look at the 6 values of the weights in this toy data sample, let's see, there's one that's like 0.06, 0.056, and here's one that's 3. So there's a large dynamic range in the weights, broad distribution of weights. So let's see. And suppose I'm interested in testing the hypothesis that mu is equal to 0. So I'm going to test the background-only hypothesis. So let's see. In this case, no matter which of those options that I discussed, the significance of the mu equals 0 hypothesis is almost the same. It's around 2.3. So this significance is just the normal way in particle physics that this is defined is I hope I'm allowed to write on this. Particle physicists talk about the significance in the following way. If you have a standard Gaussian, and that is the p-value of the hypothesis, then that number of standard deviations is the significance. All right, so that's the, in this particular example, the thing that comes out to be 2.3. Right? Regardless of what likelihood I use to define the statistic or what distribution I assume for the weights, very similar answers. But in the second case, suppose I have this very broad distribution of weights. So then, depending on what assumption I use for defining the likelihood and what assumption I make for the distribution of the weights, I can get quite different answers. So in particular, if the test statistic, if I were to use, for example, a normal distribution for the definition of the likelihood function, and if I were to assume a normal distribution for W, even though in fact the distribution was substantially broader, then this would result in a fairly large significance with which I would reject this background-only hypothesis. On the other hand, if I were to make an assumption for the distribution of weights with a longer tail, then you see that significance is substantially lower. less than one sigma significance. So that's, I think, what you would normally, what you would like to do. You would like to be conservative if you have no, if you see that there's some indication that you could have a broad distribution of weights, then you would prefer to build that in to your estimate of the significance. Okay, so that's the number I would probably want to quote. Okay, so the summary on the weighted Monte Carlo is that by treating this Monte Carlo data as real data, you can incorporate effectively the statistical error due to the limited size of the Monte Carlo sample. This runs into no problems, for example, if the number of Monte Carlo events that you find is zero. So you don't have to deal with error bars and things like zero plus or minus zero. Okay, I've written a short draft note on this that has more details, and so even though that's still a draft, I'm happy if people take a look at that for more details on that. Okay, I should move on to my second topic. One thing I will mention before I leave this topic is that if people want to discuss later, why is it that our Monte Carlo generators give weighted events, I can discuss that later as well. Okay, very good. Okay, so the second topic I want to talk about is the expected discovery significance for a counting experiment in the case where we have background uncertainty. And so just to summarize the landscape, many people have used this S over the square root of B as a measure of the expected discovery significance and used that to optimize analyses. A year or so ago, a number of us, Kyle and myself and Ofer and Elam, came up with another formula that we like to push around. And the problem with this other formula is that it still assumes that the value of B, the mean number of background events, is a known constant. But suppose it has some uncertainty, some sigma B, which is some sort of systematic error. You might say, well, I don't quite see how to generalize this to the case where you have a systematic uncertainty. So I'll go back to that and I'll say, well, root B kind of represents the amount of statistical fluctuation in the number of background events. So maybe if I add that in quadrature with this other systematic uncertainty, that would give me the quantity that I could use. And so people have been using that, at least within some of my colleagues have been using that. And the whole thing I want to propose, and I have 7 minutes now to finish talking about this, is this formula here, right, which I think works better. So let's see if I can do that in 7 minutes or less. So this just recaps the main idea of the counting experiment. I've suppressed the parameter mu now. It just goes into the parameter S. If you have, if B is known and you want to compute a p-value of the S equals zero hypothesis, then that would be the probability to find as many events as you found or more under the assumption of S equals zero. Okay, so that would be the normal p-value you would compute if you just had, if B was known. Now, to characterize the sensitivity of a discovery, what we want to do is to give the expected, or the mean or median, significance. So this formula here is basically the little cartoon that I drew there. Under the assumption of a given value of S. So the conventional thinking in particle physics for years has been that, look, if the mean of a Poisson variable gets large, then the Poisson variable becomes kind of Gaussian-like. So you could say that this N becomes something like X, which is Gaussian distributed with a mean of S plus B and a standard deviation of the square root of S plus B. So therefore, the p-value of the S equals zero hypothesis is just the probability to find X greater than or equal to the value you found, assuming S equals zero, and that's that expression there. And so if you convert that p-value to the corresponding significance, it just becomes the X that you observe minus B divided by the square root of B, and then the median, or mean, either one, of that quantity under the assumption of S plus B is just S plus B minus B over root B, so it's S over the square root of B. And that's what everybody has kind of used for a long time. But then, of course, if the numbers N are not very large, then really you should go back and treat the number as a Poisson-distributed quantity. And I'll use this same test statistic to characterize the compatibility between the N that you find and the S equals zero hypothesis, okay, so that this same profile likelihood ratio. And so that statistic, if you plug in the Poisson likelihood for that statistic, this Q0 is that formula right there, okay? So it depends on N and B. And then next time, right? If you assume Wilk's theorem, then the significance is approximately given by the square root of that Q0, which is this expression here. And then to estimate the median of that significance under the assumption of S plus B for the mean number of events, you can simply you can just replace N by S plus B. This is this Asimov trick that Kyle mentioned earlier. And that gives you then this better. Fine. So it gets this improved formula, and this reduces to S over the square root of B in the limiting case that S is much less than B. Right? And here's a plot that we already published in this paper about a year ago, as it shows the median discovery significance as a function of B for several different values of S, 2, 5, and 10. The dots are from Monte Carlo. They're exact. The red dashed curve is the naive formula that certain. So, as I mentioned, this formula here has been used by a number of people, and I'm just going to rush through this very quickly because I think I'm running out of time. If you go back to this well-studied on-off problem where you measure two Poisson distributed values, N is what you measure in the signal region, and that is distributed with a mean of S plus B, and then you have a control region with a mean of tau times B, then the likelihood function is the product of those two.
This conference will now be disconnected. Goodbye.